Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942, masterminded by and written by Colonel Mansubu Suji. We're up to chapter 27. We've had sort of a pause chapter where the Japanese have stopped and to think and contemplate what is this enemy we have in front of them, what do we want to do. There's that, and there's all these weird things happening. There's sort of a shard of compassion, samurai compassion, and a shard of we've got to get there by the Emperor's birthday. And you're sort of beginning to understand, well, these people, they're not linked to state, they're not linked to principles, they're linked to this weird, almost Walt Disney world of bad guys. They're almost the Walt Disney bad guys. But we're up to chapter 27. Small boat operations dumbfound the enemy! Exclamation mark. I'm putting that there, but I think so. The naval action of Kutam had annihilated in one blow the main strength of the British Far Eastern Fleet by sinking the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, and given us complete command of the sea off the east coast of Malaya. But Singapore remained in good condition, and the air base at Sumatra and the sea off the west coast of Malaya were still in the grasp of the British. Those who planned our small boat operations had to take due account of these facts. Our plan, which appeared to disregard the principles of war by driving our air group forward to the enemy air bases in the northern part of Malaya, was based on the assumption of air-sea cooperation. The small boats to be used were roughly 40 large, small motorboats used at Singora Landing, which, as I've mentioned earlier, had taken overland by road and rail to Lurastar River. After being launched again there, they were collected in the neighbourhood of Lamotte at the mouth of the Piak River. Together with about 20 other boats which had been captured at Penang, altogether these boats carried a battalion of infantry, more or less, and they travelled along the coast in the rear of the enemy, ceaselessly menacing their retreat. Okay, well, I should mention one of the best army camps I've done was up at Port Stephens in the little Aussie army boats. And, there was just fantastic golden waters and stuff like that. And there was a beautiful army base called Gangan. And, we went up the things and did sort of landings or whatever it is, boating, deboating, and moving supplies up, all that stuff for you. So river craft requires a lot of things. But the thing is that I think that was early 90s, then around 2000, early 90s, and then around 2005, we had a holiday out up at Port Stephens, and I got lost, and I went, I recognised the beach where we swam on, but it was a bit different. Then I went to where the army bases were. Gangan had been sold off, and the places that we were, operating had been turned into housing estates, and so you can imagine the shock and the horror. And this is also true for the Malaya emergency. So the Australian Army was back up there in 56, something like that, not long after the war. People still said, look, we went into the area, and when we came back, everything had been cleared. There was large housing things being built. They couldn't keep up with the amount of work then. Okay, so this gives me a lot of feeling for it. And so I think there's photographs of me in boats and stuff like that. You wouldn't recognise me. I'm now an old man. It was a problem that what troops to put aboard the boats to increase the scale of this operation. Eventually, the 1st Manoeuvres Unit, composed of a main strength of the 11th Regiment under command of Colonel Wantabi, in brackets, 1.5 battalions, one section of mountain guns, a section of engineers, was selected to be ferried from point to point along the coast as required to harass the enemy's retreat. At Army headquarters at Taiping, the regimental commander came to say goodbye, quote, "I wish you to keep the regimental colours at Army headquarters in Taiping," he said. "I thought, quote,
This unit is not under direct control of the Army, and as orders are given by the division commander, being sent to him from the Army, so naturally the regimental colours should be in the custody of the division commanders. The colours must share the fate of the regiment's main strength, which is putting into the operations the vital manoeuvres from which the whole Army expects to march. Expects so much. Okay, and again, there's this magical thing about the regimental colours. I myself don't quite understand it. And there's all this, the warrant officers you talk to just go on and on about, they do understand about how the flag must never touch the ground. And at the end of it, they said, Corporal Hill, you've got an Australian flag doona. I did have an Australian flag doona at home, so they knew that I had it at home, and this corporal, this warrant officer, just his eyes rolled, the idea that you would sleep under an Australian flag. Okay, so it's a bit different there. Well, of course, I don't think the Japanese, you know, have the British have these British flag boxer shorts. This is all, the colours are something magical to these people. It's natural for a regiment to protect its colours, but I have been a regimental commander. I should have wished to raid the enemy territory carrying them, for if the boats carrying the regiment were sunk, would it not be better if the colours were sunk too? Thus soldiers would be inspired by the thought that their cherished colours would share their own fate in life and death. Absolutely mad. And of course, when the Europeans came to Australia, they raised the colours, and so it really doesn't make sense to a lot of other cultures. Feelings of misgiving were apparently the regimental commander as he said the pathetic farewell before departing. General Mashita encouraged him, quote, "Don't worry about the colours," he said. "They'll be all right. I shall certainly take care of them and do your duty with all your might." While the regimental commander was going away, without knowing why, it seemed to me I should see the shadow of death at his back. The intelligence staff officer and the division at the company was to accompany the unit. In such a rating action as this, success and failure hinges on selection of commanding officer and his staff. The staff officer Aceda, who's that super smart, daring, evil one who went into cover and inspired and everything, was considered for the task, but he had just returned after sharing the hardships of the Ando detachment. The divisional commander had no hesitation in appointing his chief intelligence officer to the position. Okay, I've worked with a lot of intelligence officers. During the night of the 30th of December, the detachment put out from Lamut at the mouth of the Piak River. While they were celebrating the New Year on open sea, they were discovered by enemy planes and swept by machine gun fire, which they returned, bringing down one plane. Oh my God, Father! A number of men in the detachment were wounded, and there was some uneasiness about the future because of the enemy's early discovery of the expedition. The infantry-laden boats nevertheless continued on their way. On the 4th of January, on reaching Sunghai, they were in positions to menace the enemy line of retreat at the rear of the main British forces. The 5th Division had for many years been trained in military landing operations. These are elite Japanese landing troops. My godfather. Everything else depended on the discretion and the general character of the commander, but this well-trained division had successfully carried out all maritime operations assigned to it. By contrast, the Imperial Guards, when they took over the small boat operations with the 5th Division, were completely without maritime experience and, quote, rushed like fools, were angels feared to tread, end quote, though not without results. Entering the port Sweetaham, which was the outer harbour of Kuala Lumpur, they landed deep in the rear of the key position of Mohib, smashing the enemy resistance and seizing strategic point of Kang above the main road south of Kuala Lumpur. This reckless action took the enemy unawares and was the real reason for the abandonment of the important capital city of the Federated Malay States. In this operation, the detachment of her men in small boats had thrown common sense to the winds, but they caused consternation to the commander in charge of the units of the British Army on the spot. In the face of a threat to his rear, he retreated immediately and swiftly, leaving our men with the objective achieved. Prime Minister Churchill from London indignantly protested to General Wavell and rebuked General Percival, which in the circumstances was not unreasonable. Quote, control of the western coast passed the Japanese army, which did not have even one naval vessel there. The failure was a blot in the history of the British Navy, wrote the old Prime Minister, who repeatedly referred to the incident. Quote, why didn't the Navy oppose the enemy advance with destroyers, submarines and aeroplanes? Quote, he asked. That was one question we also asked ourselves. Admiral Pound, replying to Churchill's rebuke, stated that his inability to prevent the Japanese attacking along the west coast of Malaya was due to the inferiority of British aeroplanes and the failure of scorched earth tactics at Penang, Japanese utilisation of small boats left behind by the British. Those may have been some of the reasons, but the reasons, but even if the British Navy had shown fighting spirit of the Japanese officers and men, it might not have been able to prevent the successful operation of a fleet of small boats. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.